I think it was that it is this crisp, clear idea. And there's been at least 100 people since I've started this that have said to me, oh, I had the same idea. I don't know exactly what it is, other than there is this rich history of connection between exploration and science, right? Like, talk about Darwin and John Tyndall and Alexander von Humboldt, and all these early explorers were scientists and certainly citizen scientists.
I'm Sean Garrity, and this is The Answers Are Out There. Today's guest is someone I have known and admired for more than a decade, and I feel very lucky that during that time, we've also become close friends. Greg Trenish's early educational years, kindergarten through part of high school, up until he got kicked out, were essentially a bust. But in his late teens, he started getting his feet under him and discovered some personal interests, one of which was adventuring in the outdoors. Over time, he evolved to a level of competence in the wild that most of us can barely imagine. He later realized he also wanted to change the world for the better. He managed to combine all these interests and eventually launched a unique and now very successful company called Adventure Scientists. Today, the thousands of adventurers his organization deploys annually go to the ends of the earth to secure often extremely difficult to obtain data for scientists. For Greg, his team's year after year impact feels like a dream come true. Greg, welcome. It's fantastic to have you here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we're going to get into this more detail later in this discussion, but give us a high-level overview that will get people in the general ballpark of what Adventure Scientists is all about.
Yeah, so all around the world, we've had more than 20,000 people come through our programs and get trained to go out and collect meaningful scientific data for more than 150 partners. We have done everything from collect the highest known plant life on Earth from Mount Everest to creating what we think is the largest data set on Earth for microplastics to creating genetic reference libraries for trees so that our partners can narrow down the origins of a piece of wood to within 20 kilometers.
Amazing. Let's go back because I think it's important. I know some of your past history. A couple of things. You didn't exactly fit into the conventional public school environment, as I recall. And you always like to be outside and exploring. So give us a little bit about that early history. Describe young Greg.
Yeah, so I grew up in the suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio. I live in Bozeman, Montana now. But in Cleveland, you know, there was these big woods behind my house that I thought were just massive when I was a little kid. But now I go back and look at them and kind of laugh at how small they are. So I remember chasing fireflies and looking for deer tracks and playing around in those woods. When I would run away from home, I would often go and hide in those woods and had my little secret spots in there. But yeah, I definitely didn't fit into a public school system very well. When I was 16, I had gotten kicked out of school and decided to pursue what they called post-secondary enrollment options. So I ended up going to a junior college and getting high school credits while I was in college. And really what it came down to is I was just bored. I was so bored in school. Science I loved. We learned about the planets and we learned about biology and simple machines and things like that. I was just fascinated by that stuff. But once we got into some of the other subjects, and I couldn't stay focused because I was just so bored. And then as a result, acted out and tried to get a lot of attention in not the best ways.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. There's a parallel track going on here, though, and that is while your stellar educational career is unfolding, you are becoming more and more fascinated with the outdoors and adventuring. Tell us a little about that. When did that start to happen? Junior high, early high school?
So it really started when I was 16. So when I was 16 years old, I went out to British Columbia. My grandma offered to send me on this trip with a group called Adventures Cross Country. We went to a place called Garibaldi Provincial Park up in the coastal range of British Columbia, and it's a backpacking and kayaking trip. I think we spent about 3 weeks just kind of traversing Garibaldi and then around Vancouver Island. And this trip changed my life. It was one of the first times in my life that I just felt like I fit in. I remember climbing up to a place called Chef's Hat Lake. I'm looking out at this view and I'm just like, oh man, I got myself up here. This is, you know, a chance for me to put everything I needed on my back and climb up to the top of this lake and look around at the surrounding peaks in the middle of this wilderness. I think I felt proud of myself for probably one of the first times in my life up to that point. You know, I had been in trouble over and over again, both in school. I had some run-ins with police at times. You know, I didn't have a ton of friends because I didn't fit in. And there was another kid on the trip, a guy named Scott, that couldn't really carry his pack. He was really struggling on that first climb we did. And we distributed his weight, and I carried Scott's apples and had those in my pack. And again, it was just like, wow, like I am useful, I'm powerful, I'm strong, I believe in myself. And those were new feelings for me. So starting to really just be curious about nature definitely started in those late teenage years. And then it really blossomed, though, when I was 18 and moved out to Colorado.
Tell us about the trajectory after you got to Colorado that led to you thinking you'd like to do something, even bigger adventures, I guess.
So, yeah, I mean, I think in Colorado, you know, I kind of got the foundation, I think, that I needed to be able to do those things. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean by that is a huge portion of my life was going up to the mountains and skiing, did some of my first backpack trips with friends from college there. And it felt like I had found my people a little bit more, where they were focused on nature and focused on pushing ourselves and exploration. And that was a really cool time, I think, to ramp up into that and start to learn about that side of myself. But it was only a dabble. I think my longest backpack trip before I then graduated from college and moved up to Breckenridge, it's probably 90 miles or so, mm-hmm. Which was long, but it was one of the few experiences like that I had had. So it was this gradual ramp, and it taught me enough to know that I liked small towns better than cities. I liked remote nature better than I liked being in the middle of it all and solitude.
So this is... As parents, you're a parent now, we tell our kids to do in your 20s, that's the time to just explore lots of things. It's a divergent process, trying to figure out what it is you like. And you're doing this, narrowing in on your interests. Things did get bigger, more than that 90-mile trek. Tell us about that.
So, you know, I had hiked the Appalachian Trail. I'd through hiked from Georgia to Maine in 2004. And then really at the exact halfway mark of that trip, I had this one moment that really changed a lot for me. And it was in Pennsylvania, and it had been raining for, you know, 17 straight days. The rocks in Pennsylvania on the Appalachian Trail are brutal. It's, you know, there's this running joke that Boy Scouts come out in the middle of the night and sharpen all these rocks because they're just, it's all this glacial moraine and glacial till that is super sharp and cuts your ankles and you fall. And when it's raining, you slip on these and get banged up. So in frustration, you know, I picked up one of these rocks, I chucked it at a tree, and I took this big chunk out of the tree. And I felt so desperately low in that moment. I'm just laying on the ground, sobbing, soaking wet, feeling really, really selfish for being out there. I'd been asking myself for some time, I'd already been hiking for 3 months at this point, and I'm saying, you know, what am I doing here? What is the point of this? It felt just selfish. And I vowed to myself in that moment that I would continue to be outside because I knew that's what I had just had to do to be happy, but that I would make a difference while I was outside. So I finished the trail. I have this habit when I say I'm going to do something, I just kind of do it. And then at the end, I went and worked in wilderness therapy. So I took other kids that had been struggling, kids that had drug problems and family problems, and I would take them out into the woods and show them around. But after about two and a half years of that, I started to just get that wanderlust again and that itch and decided I was going to go do something bigger, even bigger than the Appalachian Trail. I wasn't quite sure what. But when I started reading about the Andes, there was so much about it that just inspired me. And I asked all my friends if they'd come with me. I had 10 people say yes, and soon that was five. And then just Dea decided to come with me. And, you know, we started researching the route. I kind of assumed at the time that there would be hundreds, if not thousands, of people that had walked the length of South America. But less than 5% of the continent was talked about in any guidebooks, in any hiking books. There was just nothing. So we flew down to Quito, Ecuador, got in, you know, spent a couple days there trying to get these maps from the national military. They had 1 to 250,000 scale maps in black and white that we could copy. And we took a bus out to the equator, a place called Papakyakta, a little bit south of the equator by a few miles. And bus pulls away in this kind of cloud of dust. And we had unwedged ourselves from these seats that were not built for people our size. And we look at each other as this bus pulls away and we say, what now? And we just kind of pointed the compass south and started walking.
And give us just a brief summary of how long on the trail, how many miles was it? How did you choose your route?
At the time, we weren't really sure that we were going to walk the whole length of the continent. We didn't know we'd be the first. We didn't know any of that. What we knew was that we wanted to do a pretty epic adventure and end in Tierra del Fuego, which is the very southern tip of the continent. We have a rough guess that it was about 7,800 miles. We stayed as close to the spine of the Andes as we could without relying on roads or mountaineering gear. We ended up being down there for a total of 22 months, 667 days it took us. The one break we took, it was when I got typhoid fever. I lost about 30 pounds and was pretty sick and flew home to get better and then went back down there 3 weeks later and just continued where we were.
7,800 miles, and National Geographic took an interest at that point.
Yeah, so before the trek, I had written about 300 letters, typed up this really nice letter about what we were going to do. And 297 companies dismissed us. And three of them wrote back and said, oh, this is really cool. We'll give you a free backpack. We'll give you a free pair of shoes, whatever. And we took that backpack from Granite Gear. You know, in exchange, they asked if we would tell our story when we were done. Fast forward now 2 years later, and we're in a parking lot at the City Creek Inn in Salt Lake City, Utah, at the outdoor retailer show, which they had paid for our gas money to get down there from Montana, where we moved after the trail. We presented, we opened for a guy named John Bauermaster, who's a you know, nine-time National Geographic Expeditions Council grantee and just an amazing guy. And I think because John was speaking, so in the audience was National Geographic, unbeknownst to us. And so we spoke and didn't think much of it. Had a great time at the outdoor retailer show. About 3 weeks later, we're back in Bozeman and we got a phone call that just said, hey, this is National Geographic. Can you be in DC in 3 weeks? And said, well, yeah, why? And they said, you've been named National Geographic Adventurers of the Year. And, you know, first backflip I think I ever did and probably last. But yeah, it's pretty amazing opportunity.
Incredible. Take us then from there. This not easy to comprehend adventure. Tell us, how did that lead to the beginning of Adventure Scientist?
Yeah, so I'm in this dried up riverbed in northern Chile, and you know, beautiful, walking down this riverbed on rocks again. Maybe there's something there. Maybe I need to go walk on rocks when I'm at pivotal life moments. But I've been asking myself for some time, and I continued asking myself from that point in northern Chile down to the very southern tip of the continent. You know, what next? What would I do if I had $1 billion? What would I do if I could make any choice in the world? And, you know, when you're walking at this natural human pace and you're walking from town to town, from resupply to resupply, you're following waterways, you're following these natural pathways, some of it Incan pathways, some of it was old game trails, some of it was just bushwhacking, but you see how it's all connected. But the understanding that I had of the ecology around me was lacking, and my passion for wildlife increasing. And so I decided I was going to come study wildlife. And actually, after I got the Nat Geo Award, I wrote a woman named Emma Stokes, who at the time had just discovered about 100,000 lowland gorillas. And I poured my heart out about how much I love gorillas and feel this kinship with them. And, you know, and it was genuine, but she wrote back and said, Greg, I would love to have you come and study with me on gorillas, but I just shifted to Tigers, and I had just poured my heart out about Gorillaz, so I couldn't write back and say, I also love Tigers. So that didn't work out, but I got a great job here in Bozeman tracking lynx and wolverines and grizzly bears in the summer. Best job ever. I would go to a trailhead and jump on his snowmobiles and drive up to as far as I could, then get on my skis and start looking for wolverine and lynx tracks. And when I'd find them, I'd follow them for days at a time and document everything I'd see and start telling some of the first real stories of the behavior of these animals as they were moving across large landscapes like the Northern Rockies. Eventually, we started engaging the public in this work. We'd meet up in a parking lot and have 100 people come trying to learn how to distinguish between all of the large mammals that have pads that are 4 inches or bigger, you know, mountain lions and lynx and wolverines and wolves, you know, all the different potential animals. And then they'd go out looking and report to us when they'd see them. And then I also started taking these biological expeditions where I would work with the Craighead Institute here locally, the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, and come up with a protocol. And we would put ourselves in the brain of a grizzly bear or a wolverine. I took a 700-mile trek or 620-mile trek from the eastern side of Yellowstone to the western side of Idaho to document infringements to wildlife connectivity, following what the models showed is where these large carnivores would move.
Yeah. And you began to think about, with that job, you began to think about starting something on your own rather than going to work for somebody else.
So it was kind of all at once. I was doing this expedition style travel, engaging the public and out on these field jobs. And I saw that I don't have a PhD. I have an undergrad. I did get a second undergrad in wildlife biology from Montana State. But, you know, I have an undergraduate degree. I don't have any special skill set. My brothers will tell you I'm not especially athletic. But here I am in the outdoors, like doing something really meaningful for so many different species.
Yeah.
And I was getting Chinese food for lunch one day with my hiking partner, and it like dawned on me, why don't I start some kind of organization that is going to give outdoor adventurers an opportunity to collect meaningful data? There's so many scientists who need data. There's so many adventurers who want to make a difference, but they don't know how.
And so you had that thought. What was the idea that the crystallized mission of the enterprise you were going to start? What was your vision at that time?
The mission and the vision back then, in hindsight, was that we are going to create an organization that gave outdoor adventurers traveling all around the world the opportunity to collect scientific data that would advance science, that would advance conservation, really. I didn't have any background in this at all. But what I did have was an incredible network. So Conrad Anker is one of the world's greatest mountaineers and lives here in Bozeman. And I knew him through National Geographic. And I had coffee with him a few times and asked if he would meet with me. And I went to his office and I was telling him about this idea. And he just loved it. And he said he had helped me get it started and joined my board. And then when Conrad joined, Scott Creel joined. And when Scott joined, John Bauermaster joined, the guy that I was speaking in front of at the parking lot. And Celine Cousteau, Jacques Cousteau's granddaughter. And each of those people brought the others. And so, yeah, we had 7 or 8 people in those early years that were an advisory council. And that plus Google did a lot for me.
So it's really interesting about that phase is you came up with something, you set about to build an organization to deliver on that idea. But in those early days, sometimes this doesn't happen with entrepreneurs, is that you begin to explain your idea and people go, that sounds great. Let me know how it, keep me in touch and let me know how it goes. And instead you're attracting all these people because it seemed to be such a clean mission, if you will, or an idea. And this is exactly what we want to do. And they just got it. And the magnetism started. Those people you're mentioning are not people whose attention is easy to grab and sustain. And they all wanted to gather around you and help in any ways they could.
I think it is that, Sean. I think it was that it is this crisp, clear idea. And there's been at least 100 people since I've started this that have said to me, oh, I had the same idea. I don't know exactly what it is that attracted people, other than there is this rich history of connection between exploration and science, right? Like some of the early explorers were on scientific missions. Talk about Darwin and John Tyndall and Alexander von Humboldt, and all these early explorers were scientists and certainly citizen scientists.
And you walked on your South American trip right through Humboldt's stomping grounds there.
That's right.
So explain the problem that adventure scientists is trying to address. How does lack of obtainable science data slow the work of scientists who are trying to save nature and biodiversity? You know what I mean? How does adventure scientists help speed up that work?
Yeah. And so it's not just the scientists. There's actually, you know, we work with partners that are quite varied, from NGOs to scientists to businesses, anybody who really could accelerate or amplify the impact that they can have through access to data. You know, we have three criteria for each of our projects. And the first is that there has to be a big environmental issue that's worth solving. There has to be a clear need or an opportunity if we have access to data that it can move the needle. And then there has to be a clear need for field data collection. You know, the reality is the world is awash in data. We have more data accessible at our fingertips than we ever have before. But the types of data we have still requires boots on the ground. You know, we haven't replaced that yet. Maybe someday we're going to have little butterfly drones flying around that can get anywhere on Earth. But today, we still need access to the remote portions of the globe, and we need to get that at a scale that is otherwise not possible. So our model brings to the table this scaled data collection for actually getting out on the ground, and that's testing soil, testing water, being able to pull genetics from a tree. Today, you can't do that from a satellite. You can't do that from a drone. You can't do that without getting somebody into the field who's trained to collect these data.
So talk about the customers who come to you and say, hey, we need some data. We've looked around our team and nobody wants to do what you're asking them to do to go get the data. Who are some of these customers? Tell us some stories about what it is they want and why they want it.
Yeah, well, it's varied again. Like, it's everyone from NGOs that just haven't built out this volunteer management capacity. And we're talking about hundreds, some cases, thousands of individuals that are going out. It's everyone from the Smithsonian, who's hired us to build out a training for coral cryopreservation. So you literally collect the sperm of corals, freeze them, and then when the conditions are exactly right, you can then release these and inseminate corals. We're not technical experts in any of that, but what we do really well is we build out these trainings. So that's one example. We have what's called our platform, and the platform was designed and engineered for people who want to manage a project themselves, do have that capacity. They can just get the volunteer network and access the volunteer network through us. So this is now, if you're an adventurer, you post where you're going or where you live. If you're a scientist, you post where you need data from, and it matches you together. We also have clients like the U.S. federal government, who hired us to do a full project management, where we recruit, we train, we manage, we follow up, we do the analysis, and we give them the data. And so in that case, there were three federal agencies that hired us: Park Service, Forest Service, BLM. We have NGOs like, you know, American Prairie,
right,
that we've worked with, where we had people from, I think, over 20 countries came from around the world and lived on the prairie and woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning, did sage grouse lek counts, and then we're walking 12-mile transects every single day, and compiled just this incredible list of the baseline wildlife that's out there on the prairie, so that when you all are successful, you know, 50 years from now, and there's just, you know, 4 million acres protected and contiguous across northeastern Montana, we'll know exactly what wildlife was here when you were just getting started.
And I can tell you, I was there a few times, and they go out, they walk 10 miles one direction, move over 300 yards, then come back. And two specific times I remember. One, it was about 103 degrees in the summertime there. Lots of mosquitoes, and these guys were doing that. They were heading out in that kind of weather and walking and paying attention with their iPads or whatever those little things were, noting all kinds of science data that you're gathering. And I just thought, these are unbelievably tough people. And 6 months later, I'm back, and it was about 10 to 12 below zero one morning. I was just there picking up somebody to go to a meeting, and they are up rummaging around. I get up, And I thought I was going to say hi to them because like 5 a.m. I get up. They're all gone already. They're walking out at 15 below zero, dark. The stars are out and they're off on their transects doing that. And I just thought, I'm really glad I don't work for Adventure Scientists doing that. So I sat down, had my coffee. And they're amazing. And one thing I noticed, Greg, well, this is really interesting and pertinent to today. Everybody's worried about what is AI going to do in terms of putting certain jobs away and putting whole industries out of business. Describe a couple of things just to give people a tangible example of maybe deployments you have sending people around the world that obviously AI can't touch this one and never will be able to.
Yeah. Well, we use AI in the analysis all the time. So yeah. One of the examples is, you know, we send people out across the ranges of trees that are poached. So you may not know this, but $150 billion a year are stolen out of forests around the world. $150 billion. And the more shocking statistic is that up to 1 in 3 wood products are illegally sourced. 1 out of 3. That is just mind-boggling to me. And so what we do about this is we go send hundreds of volunteers out to the range of a tree species. Mm-hmm. We've taught them how to drill a tiny little core into the tree that doesn't hurt the tree, but it allows us to get the heartwood at the center of the tree. Now, our partners at the U.S. Forest Service, brilliant researchers there, and also U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, are able to analyze the genetics and the chemicals to narrow the origins of a piece of wood down to within 30 kilometers. Actually, I'm sorry, 20 kilometers today. And we keep being able to pinpoint where a piece of wood has come from to a smaller and smaller area. And what we do with that is we can look at, all right, we think this piece of wood or the person who is possessing this piece of wood has told us this is from Southern Oregon. Well, the genetics show it's not from Southern Oregon. Their permit only covers Southern Oregon. Therefore, we know that this has not been legally sourced. And we're on to now 4 new species this year. We've already completed 6 on these reference libraries. We're also working now on being able to prove sustainability of harvest. So the EU just passed a law that said all imports have to be certified to be sustainable harvests. So using that same methodology, we can show that the wood that has made it over to Europe has come from a certain radius and that radius does vary for any given species, but incredible technology.
Now, this is heartening to hear. It's a different approach. My wife, Gail, and I were just spent 5 weeks in the Philippines, just got back, and we learned many things. But one is that illegal logging is rampant. And so you're not trying to necessarily stop things at the source, like trying to stop rhino poaching at the source for ivory. You're going to where the product is sold and causing people to steer away and not want to purchase the product because you can prove that it was not legally harvested. So you're going way downstream, almost to the end user, if I understand it. Is that right? Did I get that right?
Yeah. And someday we would love to see this. Even, you know, you walk through your Home Depot, you walk through your IKEA, and you can scan a little barcode or you have a little genetic tester, and it tells you exactly the origin of this. Today, you can walk through Walmart and scan the barcode and see the exact farmer who grew your coffee. Yeah. We want to do that for wood. So yeah, it's all across the supply chain. You know, ultimately, we want it to be that every home that's built is sourced from legally harvested and sustainably harvested timber. So you could have a genetic test for the builder to use. You could do it at the supplier. So you could do it at the level of the consumer. You could do it at the level of the timber yard. Really anywhere across that supply chain, we can intervene with these tests. And so that is exactly the next phase of it is now that we can show the illegality of this. And by the way, we've had multiple prosecutions now in the United States. The Department of Justice has used our data to prosecute timber theft.
Wow.
That's incredible. But we want to make it not that we're prosecuting people, but that we're just proving legality. So we're working towards being able to create these reference libraries so that we can prove legality down the road.
This is really interesting. And as you said, the only way to make this happen is to have real boots on the ground to go gather DNA. You can't send a robot into the forest necessarily to do this. You need people who are capable of getting to really difficult to access areas. In other words, adventurers. Let's talk about them a bit. What's the personality profile of someone who would a volunteer? And I think it's important to point out these are volunteers, they're not paid. What are they like? What do they do in their normal life, such as they'd have the time to do this and they would want to endure the hardships that you create for them in accessing this data?
Yeah, we get all kinds of people. And, you know, we're talking a little bit about the extreme, you know, the Everest and these conditions on the prairie. But I do want to stress, we also have, you know, your day hikers. This is accessible to everybody who loves the outdoors, and each protocol is different. So there are some projects like where we need highly specialized people, but there's others where the tree project, for example, you can go out and be less than a mile from a trail or a road and drill these trees. And we teach you how to do that. And you don't need any special outdoor skills other than being able to go on a hike. But yeah, the demographics, we skew pretty young compared to a traditional volunteer organization. A lot of people in their early to mid-20s really get excited about this. We do require that you're 18 or older to go out by yourself, but we have a bunch of kids that go out with their parents as well. And then there's another huge group of retirees that get really excited about this and volunteer for us. You know, we're really keen on increasing all kinds of diversity of our volunteer audience too. And so we're doing a lot of different things to try to increase age, racial, economic, all kinds of things to increase the diversity that we have in that pool as well.
Well, it's putting people outdoors in such an interesting way. And as you've said a number of times, these are folks who are interested in, they're adventurers already. They're already ready to go, but you're offering them an opportunity to move from being a terrific adventurer to adventuring with a purpose. And yes, it seems like they are all really attracted to that. I want to ask you, you describe your service as being able to obtain science data from essentially anywhere on Earth. Describe some of the more unusual assignments you've come up with and had to deploy people on.
Yeah, well, they're varied, right? We have all kinds of different projects. That Timber Project is a great example. We've collected the highest known plant life on Earth with two rock star Argentinian climbers up near Camp 2 on Mount Everest. We have had people float the length of the Amazon River from source to sea, where they were documenting all the different wildlife that they could find along the way. The Microplastics Project from source to sea. I think we did water quality down on the Amazon at one point, and we're actually working on a new project now, maybe a little premature for me to talk about, but I'll give a sneak peek that we'll be looking at mercury across the Amazon with 8 different countries.
Okay, mercury in the water.
Yeah, which is generally from artisanal mining.
Ah, interesting. Huh.
Yeah. We have another one where we're diving off the west coast of Mexico, surveying coral reefs. We have 4 people in a team that do transects, and they're doing echinoderm counts, fish counts. They're measuring what's called the rugosity of the reef, which is basically like the topography or the up and down of the reef.
And I was noticing that the people, though, to go on these dives, it's pretty strict requirements in terms of, like, I couldn't go. I have an open water Patty diver certification, but I couldn't go because you need 25 dives to be able to do that. Or these people have to be very experienced to work for you as volunteers to go get this data, right?
Yeah. And that particular project, we've actually even upped the number from there, because what we found is, so I myself am an open water diver as well. And I went down for the launch of this project and dove, and the researcher, I come up afterwards and the researcher is just like, Greg, you were a disaster under there. And I totally was, because I have probably, 25, 30 dives under my belt. But the people who can really control their buoyancy, the people who have hundreds of dives under their belt, are what we need. In this case, you're dropping a big chain that weighs about 10, 15 pounds. And so you have to be able to control your buoyancy as your weight is shifting over the course of a transect.
Now, I saw another project, the microplastic ones, was fascinating. The number of people you have out there getting stuff for you, in this case, water samples with microplastics, is kind of mind-boggling to me. The complexity of first finding all these people and then coordinating all of them that you deploy on an annual basis, it seems mind-boggling. How do you do it?
Yeah, this has been the easiest part of what we do, because the reality is the outdoor community and the way that we started this, those people are so interested in doing something, right? It's no longer armchair conservation is a thing of the past. People really want to get out and make a difference. And they, you know, once they apply their labor to these, they own those issues. They become part of who they are. So it's been shockingly easy to find and tap into those communities. Early on, we started by working with top-tier athletes in the outdoor community, guys like Jeremy Jones and Travis Rice, who are, you know, snowboarders, and people like Lakey Peterson, one of the top female surfers in the world. And we relied on those types of people to help us build a network and get the word out about what we do. But today, we actually have wait lists for almost every project we do. We ran for the last 3.5 years a wild and scenic river water quality monitoring project where we had, six to 800 spots available for volunteers. And the wait list was double that. We have people that just were so hungry to get involved in these issues. And so, you know, today, because we've built this network, it's social media, it's our newsletter, it's the hardest part is when there's a gap in the data. So we'll run a project for a year and then there's, you know, Southern Mississippi, there'll be a little spot left on the map that we haven't covered. So we, you know, we'll figure out, is there a university we can tap into? Is there a outdoor hiking group we can tap into? And our team is just amazing at figuring out how to plug those gaps and get it all done.
So you deploy these people around the world. I know you don't pay them, but I remember a while ago talking to you about a project. I think it was off the north coast of New Guinea, but you had to get people there. You had to give them kayaks. You had to figure out how they got fed. So there are costs to making these trips happen. I know the customers, whether it's a university who's looking for data or the Forest Service, will pay you money to help support a trip. But you also do, why do you have to do fundraising? Who else supports you?
Yeah. And I should mention that we are on the cusp of international expansion. We early on in our history, we worked a lot internationally. That microplastics project was 3,000 locations around the globe. But the world has changed. There's something called Nagoya Protocol now, which limits the transfer of biological material from place to place. There's all kinds of new considerations about indigenous rights and what's called access and benefit sharing for any kind of data that's getting collected in places around the globe. So we're really cautious of we don't want to go into a place and extract anything. We want to partner with locals. We want to make sure that it's local people that are gaining the capacity and the training to be able to go and collect these data. So in some cases, we actually are starting to pay people internationally, at least, and especially local communities. But you know, that's kind of a new program for us. And what's next, I would say. Today, the way most of our projects work, we certainly have that fee-for-service model still in operation, and we also do a lot of partnerships these days. So we'll find a university, we'll find an NGO, whoever it is, jointly develop the project, design it, and then go seek funding together. You know, we'll go to foundations, we'll go to federal funds, it really just depends on the project and what the landscape looks like for that.
I had a question back to you, the adventures that you reel in to go do these projects for a period of time. I've had a chance to meet a few of them and stay in touch with them. There's a young man named Morgan, I think he was from Australia.
Yeah.
And I just noticed, he articulated this quite well, that the experience of being an adventure scientist volunteer on the projects he was involved with, I think really changed him as a person. He began thinking differently about what he wanted to do with his career. He learned an awful lot more about nature and biodiversity than he knew being a big time adventurer. He's certainly capable of being able to endure hardships and do hard work in the outdoors. But what are the things, what do you notice happens to your participants when they come? Does anything strike you like Morgan or others that you say they arrived in this way and I watched them kind of transform through their experience?
It's amazing. Like, first of all, even just going out once with us, Morgan, who you're talking about, great photographer as well.
Yeah.
Really amazing guy. And I agree, like his whole life changed. I think he went on to get a master's degree in ecology. And this happens over and over again. Our volunteers go on to create their own organizations. We've had at least two pop up from the microplastics project. They tell us that they're overwhelmingly more likely to pursue careers and education in conservation than they were before working with us. And, you know, we've got these metrics that we're always improving and always relying on. But even if you go out for us once and you walk through the forest and you're looking for, you know, a particular species of tree or a plant or whatever it is, you tune in to nature in a way that you just never did before. It gives you a fresh pair of eyes. You notice things in a way that you just didn't before. And I've had this experience when I first started doing field work, but over and over and over again, it is so powerful to see that people who go out and do this not only see the world differently, but they teach others about it. And that impact is hard to measure, but it is awesome. And people just love the experience, and it is absolutely life-changing for them. Not only because they see the forest differently, but they also see the world differently. They see that there are ways that they can make a difference and be part of the solution. That's empowering, and that is exactly what we need to not only combat disinformation and a lack of trust in scientific data, but to change these issues. We need collective effort and crowdsourcing, and that's what we provide.
Yeah. I've seen some people lit up by these experiences that you provide for them while they're going out to get science data. And a number of times at American Prairie, when they came back in the evenings, having had done these incredibly long walks, and not just walking, but doing important science collection along the way. So it's work for sure. And they come back, they kicked off their boots and they're still all grubby, but they're mosquito bit or their fingers are cold, whatever. They're sitting there drinking beer and talking with each other. They are so excited about what they did that day as a team. I'm big into teamwork, as you know, and just looking at their faces, these young folks, you know, in their mid-20s or late 20s or so, how I think there's some pride in it, but there's just a satisfaction that you can't get. A lot of people never experience in their lives doing something like that with other people, knowing you're working on something meaningful and important. It leads me back to you. How does being involved in this type of work affect you personally? I mean, what feelings are associated with leading adventure science and trying to help the natural world?
Yeah. I mean, it's my personality is one where I always want to push, right? Like I always am looking for how can we have more.
I've noticed that about you. I have.
How can we have more impact? How can we make more difference? How can we do it more efficiently? How can we constantly improve? I believe in just constant iteration and constant improvement. And so it's hard for me to stop and celebrate as much as I know that I should. And look at what we've accomplished. And I am extremely proud of what we've accomplished, but there's so much more that we could do and will do. And that's where my focus goes.
For more information about Greg and Adventure Scientists, check out all the links in the show notes. Today's episode is produced by Chrissy Bodznik. Our webmaster is Sarah Saxton. Original music was composed by Trace Ketterling.